Amen, we echoed. Adam's face looked up at us quizzically, strangely pale in the light of the torch.
Just in case, the vicar said.
Thank you,
Adam said quietly, and was gone. I recognized the vicar's words as being from the Order of the Burial of the Dead, Psalm 90. But why had he chosen them? Was he thinking of St. Tancred? Of Adam? Of his lost Hannah? Or of himself? The ladder trembled as Adam descended. I peered over the edge to watch as he pulled an elaborate flash unit from the bag. The shaft and even the chamber where we stood were soon illuminated by a series of white lightning flashes from the pit. There wasn't much to see from directly above. I was content to linger and listen. At first there was silence and an occasional muffled exclamation, and then Adam began to whistle. I knew the tune at once. It was a song we had sung in Girl Guides, and its words went through my mind. Pack up your troubles in your old kit bag, and smile, smile, smile. While you've a Lucifer to light your fag, smile, boys, that's the style. A Lucifer, of course, was a type of match used during the First World War, tipped with sulfur and a dried paste made up of phosphorus and potassium chlorate. It was also a nickname of Satan, and of St. Tancred's stolen diamond. No one in the chamber above was smiling as the song urged us to do. The workmen looked uneasily at one another, as if some great taboo had been broken by Adam's whistle, which was still echoing eerily up from the pit.
Adam, the vicar called down.
Sorry,
the word floated up from the grave and hung echoing in the air. Was he whistling without thinking? Or was there a message in his choice of song? If so, who is it meant for? It was then that I became aware that several others had joined us in the crypt. One was a large man wearing a black suit, a clerical collar, and a look of stressed holiness. The bishop, there could be no doubt about it.
Your Grace, the vicar said, and Chancellor Ridley Smith.
He shook hands with each of them, neither with any real joy.
So this was Chancellor, or Magistrate Ridley Smith, Jocelyn's father.
The first thing I noticed about him was that I had seen him before. He was the man in the photo presenting the trophy to Miss Tanti. I studied him carefully. A rigid man, I thought, with hard but watery brown eyes, which shifted sideways professionally, going constantly from one of us to another, like the carriage on a typewriter. The sockets in which they were mounted were round and staring, and I pitied at once all the accused who had ever been made to stand before him in the dock. His brow was permanently wrinkled, like that of a person who had just got a whiff of something nasty, an impression that was heightened by the fact that he hadn't a trace of eyebrows or eyelashes. His blotchy nose was flattened, as if he had boxed in his youth, but not very well. A boozer, I decided. Although he was not physically large, Magistrate Ridley Smith's very presence seemed to use up all the remaining air in the crypt, which was suddenly stifling. He stood teetering on curiously tiny feet, glaring impatiently at his surroundings.
Let's get on with it, then,
he said in a remarkably hoarse, thick voice, pulling a half-hunter watch from his waistcoat pocket and consulting it with protruding lower lip.
Where are the remains?
As he fumbled to put the watch away, I couldn't help noticing that his wrist, like that of Mrs. Ridley Smith in the photograph at Bogmore Hall, was peculiarly weak and floppy. What was it Doggerud said? A classic case of lead poisoning. Had the magistrate, in those long-ago days in India, been exposed to his wife's toy soldiers?
We haven't brought them up yet, the vicar said. I thought it best if we waited until you... Yes, well then, you are keeping the church, the judiciary, and the constabulary waiting. I suggest we proceed.
By the church, he meant the bishop. By the judiciary, himself. Who on earth was representing the constabulary? And then I saw Inspector Hewitt. He was standing in the shadows behind the bishop. I smiled at him, but he did not appear to have noticed me. His eyes were moving as coolly round the crypt as Magistrate Ridley Smith's, perhaps even more coolly.
Proceed,
the bishop ordered, licking his lips. At that very instant, Adam's head appeared at the top of the ladder, his chin just level with the stone edge of the saint's grave. I was reminded, for an instant, of the head of John the Baptist.
Right then, he said, destroying the illusion. All clear below.
Who is this man? Magistrate Ridley Smith demanded. He oughtn't to be mucking about down there. Who gave him permission?
We did, the bishop said. You may recall.
But Magistrate Ridley Smith was not listening. His face was a thundercloud.
Come along, Martin, he growled, and stepped clumsily out through the archway.
Martin, the fourth workman, Martin, the silent one, Martin, who had not spoken a word since I had first seen him, said in a flat, frayed voice,
Now we're in for it.
5 words. But that was all it took to set my mind spinning like a Catherine wheel, sending off showers of sparks in all directions. That voice, I had heard it before. But where? My sense of hearing had never let me down in the past, and I did not expect it to do so now. I replayed the man's words in my mind.
Now we're in for it.
In a back room of my brain, something went click, and I heard that same voice saying,
Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky, Franz Schubert, Swan Lake, Death and the Maiden.
It was the voice I had heard issuing from the concealed loudspeakers in Jocelyn's room at Bogmore Hall.
Benson!
This otherwise silent workman was Jocelyn's keeper. He had been sent here right from the very beginning to spy on the opening of St. Tancred's tomb. I knew when I saw the side of his face on the staircase that I'd seen him before, but couldn't think where. It had, of course, been right here in the crypt, where his silent presence in the shadows drew little attention. Now he was leaving the stony chamber, shuffling away in his master's footsteps. As if to confirm what I already knew, Tommy said,
Ta-ta for now, Benson.
Yes, well then, the bishop said. I propose we get on with it. It's late. Easter is tomorrow. We've only a few hours left and much to do. Please inform us when the relics have been collected, Mr. Haskins, and we shall prepare the ossuary.
Then he, too, was gone. Adam climbed up onto the ledge and sat with his legs dangling into the pit. From somewhere down below came a wooden banging, and the ladder rattled against the stone edges.
Hello, Adam said, looking down into the pit. Something stirreth in the grave.
Again the ladder shook, and a red face appeared, streaked with mud and surprised to see us. It was Sergeant Graves.
Right you are, Chief,
he said to Inspector Hewitt, pointing the beam of his torch back down the way he had come.
It goes right the way through from here to the churchyard.
Brilliant, I wanted to say, but I kept my mouth shut.
It was obvious that the other branch of the tunnel, the one I had not taken, led down into the actual tomb of St. Tancred. The sergeant scrambled up off the ladder and sat himself beside Adam on the edge, brushing the filth from his clothing. The inspector nodded, his face a mask. He did not say, what must surely have been on his mind, that the sergeant's passage, like a pipe cleaner through the tomb, had almost certainly destroyed traces of those who had looted it. But then, too, so had my own explorations, so I decided to say nothing. Perhaps the inspector didn't even know about the heart of Lucifer. Nor, perhaps, did the bishop or the chancellor. I had once heard a saying that went like this. Least said, soonest mended. I would keep my tongue tamed and my lip sipped. Never let it be said that Flavia Deluce was a blabbermouth. But what was this? Inspector Hewitt had caught my eye and was motioning with a sideways jerk of his head and an upward rolling of his eyes, a message I could read as clearly as if it were a newspaper headline. Upstairs, it said, now.
We were strolling pleasantly in the long grass at the back of the churchyard, the inspector and I.
Your footprints are everywhere in that tunnel, he said, pointing back toward Cassandra Cottlestone's busy tomb.
I pretended surprise and bafflement. I could easily point out that there were plenty of people who wore plimsolls.
Don't bother, he said. We have your footprints on file. As well as your fingerprints, he added.
Well, I said, it's a long story. There was a bat in an organ pipe, and I was trying to find out how it got into the church. I was afraid it might be rabid. I didn't want anything to happen to Feely. She's engaged to be married, you know, and I was afraid. I flipped on the switch marked shuddering sobs, but nothing came. Damnation! I used to be a dab hand at water on demand. What on earth was happening to me? Was I becoming hardened? Was this what being 12 was going to be like?
Very commendable, I'm sure, the inspector remarked. And what did you discover while you were down the rabbit hole?
When tears fail, I decided on the spot, dazzle them with details. I rattled off a quite decent reply. The tunnel leads from the Cottlestone tomb to the space where I found Mr. Corlicut's body. There was another branch, but I didn't follow it. There's a stone that can be moved with iron handles. That's how they dumped him there. He was murdered in the organ chamber and brought down either through the crypt or outdoors through the churchyard. By the footprints that were there before mine, I suspect there was more than one killer.
Anything else? The inspector asked.
No, I said, lying through my teeth. How could I possibly even begin to tell him about Miss Tanti, or Mad Meg, or Jocelyn Ridley-Smith, or Mrs. Battle, or even, for that matter, about Adam and the Heart of Lucifer? As I had noted before, I needed to leave him something to discover for himself. It was only fair.
Flavia?
I loved it when he said my name.
You must remember that there are dangerous killers on the loose.
My heart accelerated.
Dangerous killers on the loose. The words which every amateur sleuth lives in eternal hope of hearing.
Ever since I first heard them spoken on the wireless by Philip O'Dell in The Case of the Missing Marbles, I had longed for someone to say them to me, and now they had. Dangerous killers on the loose. I wanted to shake the inspector's hand.
Yes, I said. I know. I'll be careful. It's not just a matter of being careful. It's a matter of life and death.
A matter of life and death. That other great phrase. Perhaps even greater than dangerous killers on the loose. My cup of crime runneth over, I thought.
Flavia, you're not paying attention to me.
Yes, I am, Inspector, I assured him. I was just thinking how grateful I am that you warned me.
You're to stay strictly away from the church. Do you understand?
But tomorrow is Easter.
You may attend with your family. That is all.
That is all? Was I being dismissed? Chopped like a chambermaid who'd been surprised with her snout in the sherry? He was already striding away through the long grass when I thought to call after him. Inspector, how is Mrs. Hewitt? He did not stop and turn around. In fact, he didn't even slow his steps. It was obvious he hadn't heard me. Chapter 24. I knew, don't ask me how, even as I steered Gladys between the stone griffins of the Mulford gates, that something else had gone wrong at Buckshaw. It's hard to explain, but it was as if the house were vanishing between heartbeats, as if it were being partially erased and then restored by the unseen artist who was drawing it. I had never in my life experienced anything like this.
The avenue of chestnuts seemed never-ending. The harder I pedaled, the slower seemed my approach. But at last I reached the front door and opened it. "Hello?" I called out, as if I were a traveller coming unexpectedly upon a witch's cottage in the woods. As if I hadn't lived here all my life. "Hello? Anyone here?" There was, of course, no answer. They would be in the drawing room. They were always in the drawing room. I raced into the west wing, my feet thudding along the carpets. But the drawing room was empty. I was standing, puzzled, in the doorway when something bumped behind me. The sound must have come from Father's study, one of the two rooms at Buckshaw that were off limits. The other was Harriet's boudoir, which, as I have said, Father had preserved as a memorial in which every scent bottle, every last nail file and powder puff was kept in precisely the same position as she had left it on that last day. The boudoir was not to be entered under any circumstances, and Father's study was to be entered only upon command. I knocked and opened the door. Dogger looked up, surprised. Hadn't he heard me running in the hall? "Miss Flavia," he said, putting down a stamp album he had been about to place in a packing box. The truth was, I'd still not got over the shyness I had created by calling Dogger a pet name to his face, and at that moment I thought that I might never, ever get over it. "What's wrong?" I asked. "Where is everybody?"
"I believe Miss Ophelia has gone to a room with a headache. Miss Daphne is sorting books in the library."
I didn't need to ask why. My heart sank.
"And Father?"
"The Colonel has gone, likewise, to his room."
"Dogger," I blurted, "what's wrong? I knew something was not right as soon as I came through the Mulford gates. What is it?" Dogger nodded.
"You sense it too, miss."
Neither of us could find words, and then Dogger said,
"Colonel Deluce has received a telephone call."
"Yes? From who?"
I was too edgy to say, "from whom?"
"I'm afraid I can't answer that," Dogger said. "The call-in party would not identify himself. He insisted on speaking directly and only to Colonel Deluce."
"It's the house, isn't it?" I demanded. "Buckshaw has been sold."
My bones were boiling. My soul was freezing. I was going to vomit.
"I don't know," Dogger said. "The Colonel did not confide in me. I will admit that I thought as much myself."
If I were anyone other than Flavia Deluce, I would have marched up to Father's room and demanded an explanation. After all, it was my life too, wasn't it? But I could feel myself growing older by the minute. "Admit it, Flavia," I thought. "You simply don't have what it takes to beard the lion in his den." Which, for some odd reason, reminded me of Magistrate Ridley Smith and his peculiar lion-like face. "Dogger," I asked, switching tracks like an emergency on the railway, "what would you say if I asked you about wasted thumb muscles, a drooping hand, and dragging feet?"
"I should say you've been at Bogmore Hall again," Dogger answered, keeping a straight and proper face.
"And if I told you I hadn't?"
"Then I should ask you for more details, miss."
"And I should tell you that I had met someone who had all of those symptoms, as well as wide, round, staring eyes, no eyebrows or eyelashes, a crumbled nose, a blotchy, brownish complexion, and the most awful frown."
"And I should say, well done, Miss Flavia, a nicely observed description of facies leonine. The so-called lion face. Would it be out of place for me to ask if this person had spent time in India?"
"Spot on, Dogger," I crowed. "Spot on. A classic case of lead poisoning, I believe."
"No, miss," Dogger said. "A classic case of Hansen's disease."
"Never heard of it," I said.
"I dare say not," said Dogger. it is known more commonly as leprosy.
Leprosy? That dread disease we've been warned against in Sunday school? That dread disease which Father Damien had contracted among the lepers of Molokai? The whitened, crusted, peeling skin? The blue ulcers? The rotted noses? The toes and fingers snapping off? And the face falling at the end into a sad and incurable wreckage? The lepers of Molokai to whom the pennies from our Sunday school collection boxes were regularly sent? Leprosy. The secret fear of every girl and boy in the British Empire. Surely Dogger must be wrong.
I thought people died from that, I said.
They do, sometimes. But in certain cases, it becomes dormant, goes into a state of suspended animation for years.
How many years?
10, 20, 40, 50. It varies. There is no hard and fast rule.
Is it contagious? I asked, wanting suddenly and desperately to wash my hands.
Not as much as you might think, Dogger said. Hardly at all, in fact. Most persons have a natural immunity to the organism which causes it. Mycobacterium leprae.
I had been aching for ages to ask Dogger about his vast storehouse of medical knowledge, an urge I had so far managed to keep in check. It was none of my business. Even the slightest inquiry into his shocked and troubled past would be an unforgivable invasion of trust.
I have myself known of a case in which the bullae of the prodromal stage...
His words stopped abruptly. Yes? I prompted. Dogger's eyes seemed to have packed their bags and fled to some far-off place. A different century, perhaps. A different land. Or a different planet. After a long time, he said,
It is as if...
It was as if I wasn't there. Dogger's voice was suddenly the rustle of leaves or the sighing of the wind in a vanished willow. I held my breath.
There is a pool, he said slowly, his words strung out like beads on a long cord. It is in the jungle. Sometimes the water is clear and may be drunk. Other times it is murky. An arm dipped into it disappears.
Dogger reached out to touch something which I could not see, his hand trembling.
Is it gone? Or is it still there, invisible? One fishes in the depths, helpless, hoping to find something, anything.
It's all right, Dogger, I said, as I always did, touching his shoulder. It doesn't matter. It's not important.
Oh, but it does. And it is, Miss Flavia, he said,
startling me with his intense presence.
And perhaps never more than now.
Yes, I said automatically, perhaps never more than now. I wasn't sure that I knew what we were talking about, but I knew that we had to keep on, no matter what. Without really changing the subject, I continued as casually as if nothing had happened. Without giving away any confidences, I said, I can tell you that the person I am speaking of is Magistrate Ridley Smith. Dogger, after all, had he been with me in the crypt, might have seen him with his own eyes.
I have heard him mentioned, nothing more, Dogger said.
The other, the one I asked you about earlier, is his son, Jocelyn.
Yes, I remember. Lead poisoning.
Exactly, I said. You deduce that I had been at Bogmore Hall.
I have heard the son spoken of, Dogger said. Servants talk. One hears things at the market.
But not the father, I prompted.
No, not the father. Not at least a physical description.
Poor Jocelyn, I said. If your diagnosis is correct, his mother was lead poisoned and his father a leper.
Dogger nodded sadly.
Such things happen, he said, even though we try to pretend they do not.
Will they live? I asked.
I had worked my way slowly up to the most important question of all.
The son, perhaps, Dogger replied. The father, no.
Odd, isn't it? I said. The leprosy, now that it has come to life again, will kill him.
Leprosy in itself is rarely fatal, Dogger said. Its victims are more likely to die from kidney or liver failure. And now, if you'll excuse me, miss.
Of course, Dogger, I said. I'm sorry for interrupting. I know you have things to do. It had been a near thing. Dogger had come within a hair's breadth of sliding into one of his episodes. I knew that he wanted nothing more than to get to his room and fall quietly to pieces. The worst was over, at least for now, and he needed to be given the gift of being alone.
What's up, Daff?
I said, barging into the library as if it were just another jolly day at Buckshaw. My sister was extraordinarily perceptive, even though she pretended she was not. If there had been a crushing call on the telephone, Daffy would by now have ferreted out all the details. In that way, she was a lot like me.
Nothing,
Daffy said, without looking up from her book sorting. It seemed as if the warm feeling built up earlier by our sisterly ceasefire had leaked away like the sand in an hourglass.
Who telephoned? I asked. I thought I heard it ring a while ago.
A ringing telephone at Buckshaw was such a rarity that it could be commented upon without suspicion. Daffy shrugged and opened The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. Whatever it was that had upset Father, he had not shared it. Which, in a peculiar way, was comforting. My sisters shared everything. Whatever Daffy knew, Feely knew. Whatever Feely knew, Daffy knew. What Flavia knew was, by comparison, like the bump on the log in the hole at the bottom of the sea. Deep, dark, and nobody gave a rat's anatomy. Trying to cheer things up a bit, I said, I'm looking for a good book to read. Can you recommend something suitable?
Yes, Daffy said. The Holy Bible.
With that, she slammed shut Wildfell Hall and stalked out of the room. So much for shared blood.
Chapter 25.
Supper was a charade. Father did not put in an appearance. Feely and Daffy and I sat picking at our food, being horridly decent to one another, passing the salt and pepper and the cold peas with elaborate pleases and thank yous. It was dreadful. None of us knew for certain what was happening, either with Buckshaw or with Father, and we didn't want to be the first to ask, didn't want to be the one to throw the last pebble, the pebble which would smash, once and for all, our fragile house of glass. As if words alone could cause its final fall.
May I be excused?
Daffy asked.
Of course,
Feely and I said too quickly at the same time.
I wanted to cry.
I also wanted to go to my laboratory and prepare an enormous batch of nitrogen triiodide with which to blow up, in a spectacular mushroom cloud of purple vapor, the world and everyone in it. People would think it was the apocalypse. The sea of glass like unto crystal, the star called wormwood, the seven lamps of fire, the rainbow round about the throne, and the second angel pouring out his vial upon the sea, where it became as the blood of a dead man. I'd show them. I'd give them something to think about. The blood of a dead man. It had all begun with blood, hadn't it? That's what was dribbling through my mind as I climbed the stairs. In the beginning, there had been the blood of the flattened frog and the blood of my own family glowing with red iridescence under the microscope. There had been the stained glass blood of John the Baptist
and the blood that dripped from the brow of the wooden Saint Tancred. I had still not had the opportunity to tell the vicar the results of my analysis. There had been the red stain on the floor of the organ chamber where Mr. Corleycut was murdered. But that, of course, was not blood. It was red-colored alcohol from the organ's broken manometer. Of Mr. Corleycut's blood, there had been not a trace.
Of course,
not a single drop. Not in the chamber where he was killed, not in the tomb where his body ended up, and not, so far as I had seen, anywhere in between. In the case of Mr. Corleycut, it was not so much a case of blood stains as the lack of them. The obvious conclusion was that he had not been stabbed or shot, and poisoning, somewhat to my regret, was out of the question. In spite of what Wilfred Sowerby, the undertaker, had told Adam about internal explosions, it was obvious that those injuries were inflicted after death. No blood. QED. You didn't need to be a Professor Einstein to see that Mr. Corleycut had most likely died of suffocation. Actually, I should have spotted that as soon as I laid eyes on him. The gas mask itself told much of the story. And then, now that I thought about it, there had been that white ruffle at his chin, like the highwayman. A handkerchief, shoved under the mask. But why? The answer hit me like a dropped brick. Ether. Diethyl ether. Good old C2H52O. The stuff had been discovered either in the 8th century by the Persian alchemist Abu Abdallah Jaber ben Hayyam ben Abdallah al-Kufi, sometimes called Geber, or in the 13th century by Raymond Lully, sometimes called Doctor Illuminatus, and could in a jiff be concocted easily at home from sulfuric acid and heated cream of tartar. It could also be pinched from a hospital, or from a doctor's surgery. I could all too easily imagine Mr. Corleycut's last moments, the saturated handkerchief clapped to the nose, cold at first, then a fierce burning followed by numbness, the hot, sweet taste of it as he gasped for air, the warmth of it in his stomach, the fading of the senses, the swirling darkness. And then, what? Well, death, of course, if the ether were applied for too long or in too great a quantity. Paralysis of the central nervous system and failure of the respiratory system could possibly result if great care were not taken. I had read the grisly details in Heinrich Braun's classic text, Local Anesthesia, a well-thumbed copy of which Uncle Tar had kept on the shelf above his desk. His own experiments with procaine and stovane, named for the Frenchman Ernest Fernot, whose name in French means stove, were well documented in Uncle Tar's microscopically inked notes in the margins. But who nowadays, in Bishop's Lacey, would be able to obtain ether? Probably very few. In fact, when you came to think of it, a medical doctor was likely the only person on earth who regularly carried the stuff with him everywhere in his bag. I needed to speak to Dr. Darby. Tomorrow was Easter Sunday. He would almost certainly, barring medical emergencies, be at church with the rest of Bishop's Lacey, organizing, as he always did, the pace egging and the egg hunt. I could catch him at the lich gate and ask casually if anything had recently gone missing from his bag. But first I needed to sleep. Dogger must have brought Esmeralda in from the greenhouse, because I found her roosting contentedly on the iron ring of a laboratory support stand, and there was a fresh egg in my bed. I would save it for the morning, I decided. Tomorrow was going to be a long day. Father would have us rousted out of our beds by 5 o'clock, so we could have a light breakfast before the 3-hour curfew. As Roman Catholics, we were bound to fast from at least midnight before receiving the Holy Eucharist. Only those who were gravely ill and in danger of death were permitted their toast and marmalade in advance. Father, however, disagreed.
A hot breakfast is indispensable, if not mandatory,
he used to tell us.
You never know when or if you might eat again.
It was a piece of wisdom he had apparently formulated during his military service, but we knew better than to ask questions. In discussion with the vicar, he had settled on a time of 3 hours as being sufficient to satisfy both tummy and spirit of the law. Father, I must say, is years ahead of his time. He sees nothing wrong with receiving Holy Communion at the altar of the Church of England, rather than driving to Hindley for Holy Eucharist at Our Lady of the Seven Sorrows.
It is one's bounden duty,
he never tires of telling us,
to trade with local firms.
Well, so be it, I suppose. We would be in our pew for the 8 o'clock service, then return for the 11 o'clock service, the one with all the stops pulled out, choir, organ, the psalms and responses chanted, a bang-up sermon, the whole McGillicuddy. I dug out from under my bed the set of recordings I had pinched from Feely's bedroom, Grieg's Piano Concerto in A minor, which, according to Feely, was descriptive of sunlight and shadows on the icy fjords of Norway, with cakes of ice like diamonds the size of buckshaw breaking away and crashing down into the sea. I wound up the crank of my gramophone, lowered the needle into the grooves of the spinning disc, dived under the covers, and pulled the quilt up to my ears as the music began. With the strings of the London Philharmonic singing me asleep, I was dead to the world before the spring ran down. I dreamt I was in St. Tancred's churchyard, where tables, perhaps a dozen of them, had been set up here and there among the tombstones. At the tables were seated the people of Bishop's Lacey and surroundings, dressed all of them alike in harlequin suits of a diamond pattern. The rich colours of their silks made them seem like figures from a stained glass window. On the table, in front of each player, or contestant, I wasn't sure which, was an identical jigsaw puzzle, unopened, and behind each player stood a referee with a harlequin flag. Oh, what great fun, I thought, a jigsaw tournament. A whistle was blown, the flags came swishing down, and the players tore open the boxes and began sorting like madmen. Already one or two of them were fitting flat-edged pieces into the border. A judge in powdered wig and pince-nez strolled among the tables, pausing to watch over the shoulder of each player for a few moments before scribbling notes in a great and ancient ledger. As I moved in for a closer look at the puzzles themselves, which seemed to depict either a saint with a golden glow around his head or a moonlit rock protruding from a midnight sea, I was warned off by a dark figure in clerical garb. Could it be the vicar, who, by hand gestures, made it quite clear that any interference would be punished at once by the man with the shovel? I spun round and found myself face to face with the punisher, the man with the shovel. Miss Tanty! I awoke instantly and sat up in bed, my heart pounding. If I had not known it before, I now knew how Mr. Callicutt had been killed and why. The clock showed that it was 5:10, too late to catch another 40 winks. I jumped out of bed onto a cold floor, dashed cold water from the ewer onto my hands and face, and climbed into the starched, frilly white frock Mrs. Mullet had laid out for me, like a railway driver climbing onto the footplate of his engine. Esmeralda's egg, steamed, and a couple of pieces of bread toasted over the Bunsen burner, made for a hearty breakfast. I took a cork from a drawer and charred it in the burner's flame. When it had cooled, I applied it to my eyelids with special attention to the lowers, then rubbed at the soot until it had faded to a realistic purplish grey. As a finishing touch, I twisted my hair into a tangled rat's nest and sprayed cold water from an atomizer onto my brow. I looked at myself in the mirror. With clots of egg still clinging to my lips, the effect was remarkably convincing. Father Daffy and Feely were already at the table as I stumbled into the dining room and looked around dazedly. I took my seat without a word and sat motionless, my hands folded dismally in my lap.
"Good God," Feely said. "Look at you."
Father and Daffy looked up from their dry toast.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to be excused," I managed. "I'm sorry, I've hardly slept. I think it must have been something I ate."
I put my cupped hand to my mouth and puffed out my cheeks.
"Have a piece of toast," Father said, "then go straight back upstairs to bed. I'll look in on you when we get home."
"Thank you," I said, "but I'm not hungry." "A good long sleep will do me the world of good," I added, echoing Mrs. Mullet.
Back upstairs, I changed from Easter frock to skirt and sweater, and from my goody two-shoes into plimsolls. Minutes later, I was crawling, quietly, carefully, out the window of the portrait gallery on the ground floor. It had rained in the night and Gladys was wet. I gave her a good shaking, and the drops of cold condensation flew like a shower of diamonds in the moonlight. In less than 10 minutes, we would be at St. Tancred's.
Chapter 26.
A frail fog drifted up from the river behind the church, floating like grey smoke among the graves, muffling the sound of the running water. A churchyard in the March moonlight should be enough to give anyone the ging-gang-goolies, but not this girl. After all, I had been here before. I pounded my chest with both fists and breathed deeply of the morning's damp air, a mixture of dank earth, wet grass, and old stone, with a slight aftertaste of fading flowers. I could see why clergymen love their jobs. The ladies from the Altar Guild would soon be here, so I'd have to be quick about what I'd come to do. With any luck, I'd have perhaps an hour, or at most an hour and a half before they arrived with armloads of Easter lilies. Not that I would need that long. My dream had helped the last bits of the puzzle to fall into place. Before the dream, although I'd had all the facts, I hadn't seen how they fit together. But now, as sure as Shandygaff, I knew what I was going to find, and where I was going to find it. I stepped into the porch and flicked on the torch, taking care to keep the beam focused on the floor. Seen from outside, the slightest glimmer on the stained glass windows would make the church glow like a Tiffany lamp in the graveyard. I opened the inner door and passed from the porch into the main body of the church, or, as Feely would have said, from the narthex into the nave. When it came to ecclesiastical architecture, Feely loved to toss around technical terms as if she were chatting over tea and ladyfingers with the Archbishop of Canterbury, or perhaps even the Pope. Did the Pope drink tea? I didn't know, but I was sure Feely would be able to hold forth upon the subject until the cows came home with the cream. I stood in the centre aisle and listened. The place was filled with that utter silence which only churches can have. A silence so vast, so timeless, and so loud that it hurts the ears. An echoing vacuum of negative sound. Could it be the crying out of the dead who lay stacked within the walls and in the crypt below? Were they lying in wait, as Daffy had once told me, to seize the midnight visitor and drag you down with them into their coffins where they would munch on your bones until the last judgment, at which time they would spit them out and make haste for heaven? Stop it, Flavia, I thought. Why did I allow my mind to fill with such utter rubbish? I had been here before in the night and had seen nothing worse than Miss Tanty. Miss Tanty and Cynthia Richardson. Now that I stop to think about it, St. Tancred's in the wee hours was almost as busy as Victoria Station at midday. The boat train to heaven. Stop it, Flavia, I was allowing the place to get on my nerves, and I didn't like it at all.
I moved up the aisle a step at a time, a slow procession of one. Then suddenly, in my mind, perhaps to keep me company, Daffy was pacing along behind me, chanting in a solemn, hollow voice, "Let's talk of graves, of worms, and epitaphs."
"Stop it, Flavia, stop it at once."
With any luck, I was just minutes away from success, mere moments away from... Something creaked, something wooden by the sound of it. I froze, listened. Nothing.
"This is ridiculous," I thought.
"Besides their stones, old churches are full of oak and elm." The timbers of the roof which arched above my head, the pews, the pulpit, the railings were all, once upon a time, trees in an English forest. They had once been alive, were, perhaps, still alive, settling, stretching their sinews in their sleep. I moved up the aisle toward the organ, not daring to raise the torch's beam to see if St. Tancred was still dripping. Splotches of colored moonlight came angling in through the windows, making the shadows all the darker. Now I had reached the organ, its three keyboards gleaming in the darkness like a triple set of teeth. Something creaked. Again. Or was it something else? I shifted the beam of the torch, and the carved wooden imp grinned at me in the gloom. I pressed my ear to the wooden panel and listened, but there was not the faintest sound from the organ chamber. A twist of the imp's chubby cheeks and the panel slid open. I stepped inside. Here I was again, the spot where Mr. Quillycut died. The spot where, unless I was sadly mistaken, Mr. Quillycut had hidden the heart of Lucifer. It was simply a matter of threading the facts together in the right order, like pearls on a string. Once that was done, the solution was not difficult. I could hardly wait to explain it all to Inspector Hewitt, to deliver it up as a goodwill offering, with every last bow and every blessed ribbon tied beautifully in place. He would, of course, share the details with his wife, Antigone, who would ring me up at once and invite me round to tea once again, in spite of my past social blunders. She would remark on the brilliance of my solution, and I would say that it was nothing. The organ pipes rose all around me, thousands of them, it seemed, rank after rank, like mountain peaks of tin and wood. Each pipe had its mouth, a horizontal slit near the bottom through which it spoke, and I was as sure as I could be that into one of these Mr. Quillycut had shoved the heart of Lucifer. The question had been, which one? I had spent hours sitting on the organ bench with Feely, watching as she pulled out the stops which gave the organ its voice. The Lieblick Bourdon, the Geigen Principle, the Contrafagotto, the Gemshorn, the Voix Celeste, the Salicet, the Dulciana, and the Lieblick Gudacht. In which set of pipes would Mr. Quillycut have hidden the heart of Lucifer? Oddly enough, it had been the cast-off row of stop knobs in his bedroom that had first put the question into my head. Where would an organist hide a diamond? It was like a riddle, and like a riddle, the answer, once you saw it, was laughably obvious. In the G-E-M-S horn. The Gemshorn! Feely had explained that the Gemshorn pipes were the ones that were meant to sound like flutes made from animal horns, the ones that looked to me like pygmy blowguns. There must have been 24 of the things, ranging in length from several feet to a couple of inches. The smallest ones were too small to conceal anything, their slots too narrow to shove anything inside. I decided to begin with the largest pipe. I inserted my first two fingers into its metal mouth and felt both upward and downward, above the slot and below it. The inside of the pipe was as smooth as a tea canister. Very well then, on to the next.
I couldn't hold back a smile as I worked. Feely had complained that the organ had been out of sorts for weeks, but she had mistakenly blamed it on the weather. But I knew otherwise. Who would have thought that a hidden diamond was giving the poor, tired old instrument a frog in its throat? Flavia Deluce, that's who. Flavia, you rascal, you, I whispered, and shoved my fingers into the mouth of the next pipe. There's an unwritten law of the universe which assures that the thing you seek will always be found in the last place you look. It applies to everything in life, from lost socks to misplaced poisons, and it was certainly at work here. The only pipe I hadn't yet checked of the Gemshorn rank was the one farthest from the sliding panel through which I had entered the organ chamber. I made a mighty stretch to reach it, said a silent prayer, and slid my hand into the slot. My fingers touched something. There was a lump inside the pipe, a dried lump, like a petrified prune. I felt the thing, gently outlining its size and shape with my fingertips. It was, perhaps, the size of a walnut, and about the same texture. I wiggled it, and with a hollow snap, the thing came free and dropped into my hand. Careful, I thought. Don't let it fall down inside the pipe. I worked the object slowly, carefully toward the slot, until at last I was able to draw it out into the light of the torch. What bitter disappointment! It was nothing but a lump of old putty. I wedged the torch between two of the organ pipes, and using the thumbs of both hands, dug my nails into the lump and split it open as if cracking an egg. The heart of Lucifer. My heart gave a bound, and I'm afraid I said something quite unsaintly, which I would not be proud of later. Brought to life by the torch's beam, the huge diamond lay in my hand, shooting off sparks of light into the surrounding darkness like a new sun hatching. As I had suspected, Mr. Collicut had stuck the stone inside an organ pipe. How clever of him, I thought. And how much more clever of me to figure out how to find it. The heart of Lucifer. Imagine! I could hardly wait to tell Father. I was holding the giant gem between thumb and forefinger, turning it from side to side, sending reflections dancing in their thousands, when a voice behind me said, "Seize her, Benson!" And then everything happened at once. Someone grabbed my upper arm and dug powerful fingers into my muscles. My entire arm went weak. I spun round, kicking out at my attacker, even as I twisted away, having the pleasure of feeling my shoe meet shin.
"Damn you," a pained voice said. "I'll teach you to..."
And then the torch went out. My elbow had knocked it from between the organ pipes, and it hit the wooden floor with a dull thud. We were now in total darkness, and I opened my mouth to scream, but I did not. Rather, I did something I expect I will never forget. Hands grabbed at me and slipped off again as I pulled back and banged among the pipes. The wind chest was somewhere in the corner. Perhaps I could scramble up on top of it and hide behind. Powerful hands had seized one of my ankles and were twisting. And then the torch came on. Someone had retrieved it from the floor and was shining the beam directly into my eyes.
"Where is it?" thundered a voice from the darkness behind the light.
The voice of Ridley Smith, the magistrate. I was sure of it.
"Hand it over,"
another voice demanded, and my arm was wrenched almost out of its socket. I could see strange fingers digging into my whitening wrist.
"Hand it over and be quick about it."
"Hand what over?" I gasped. "Let go of me. I don't know what you're talking about."
"The stone,"
a voice rasped, hot in my ear. I could smell the man's breath, and it was nothing to write home about. My first reaction was to stall for time. How long would it be before help could arrive? An hour? It might as well be an eternity. Benson, for I could now see with my own eyes that he was my attacker, seized my shoulders and gave me the kind of shake a terrier gives a rat. I could feel my brain slapping against my brain pan.
"No games," he hissed, his temper short. Hand it over.
I held up my empty hands in front of me. There must be some mistake, I told him, trying my best to stare with open-eyed honesty into the torch's blinding beam. Honest? Another shake, more painful than the first. You're hurting me, I told him, my head spinning. Let me go. Another bone-rattling shake. I couldn't take much more of this. There was no escape. Both Benson and the magistrate were barring the only way out of this hellish chamber. I needed to change tactics. Slightly. All right, I said. I know that the two of you murdered Mr. Cullycut. The shaking stopped. First point went to me. Right here, I added, gesturing with my hand to take in the entire organ chamber, my breath coming in gasps. I know that you and your men have been tunneling in from the churchyard to steal the stone for ages, maybe years. I know that you, Magistrate Ridley Smith, came across the account of the Heart of Lucifer in the Public Record Office, the documents held at Chancery Lane. You hid it there in a pile of ancient charters. Who else but someone in the legal professions would have access? I was breathing heavily, as overwound as a 6-shilling clock. The magistrate said nothing. I hadn't been convincing enough. Mr. Cullycut was one of your... What was the word? Flunkies? Hirelings? Daffy would know. Employees, I settled for, aware even as I said it that it was a pretty weak choice of words. He double-crossed you. You had a falling out. You murdered him right here in the organ chamber. Method? Diethyl ether. Murder weapon? I paused dramatically. Stretch it as long as you can, I thought. A handkerchief soaked in ether and held in place by a gas mask. And then you dragged him off through the tunnel and dumped his body in the chamber on top of St. Tancred's tomb. There was a dead silence, during which Benson let go of my shoulders. That's why you forced the bishop to withdraw his faculty. You knew what they would find when the tomb was opened, and it was too late to move the body again. During all of this, Magistrate Ridley Smith had remained silent. But now he spoke, his words curiously soft in the stone chamber. Is that what you think? He asked. Is that what you honestly think? Yes, I shot back, trying to inject a certain tone of accusation into my voice. I'm afraid you have sadly misinterpreted the facts, young lady, he said. Ha, I thought. I know what he's up to, young lady indeed. He was going to sneak round the back and try to win me over with fake respect. Have I? I asked, as coldly and condescendingly as I could manage, given the situation. You have indeed, he answered, putting such heart into his words that for a moment I was almost tempted to believe him. Had I detected in his voice a sense of being shaken? You have indeed, he repeated. The truth is quite the contrary. I let him see me bite my lip. How much longer could I stall? Oh, blessed ladies of the Altar Guild, I prayed. Sprout wings, now, fly to my defense. What is the truth? I heard myself blurt, recalling vaguely that Pontius Pilate had once used similar words, but in quite different circumstances. The truth is that we tried desperately to revive Cullycut. Benson used a length of hose from the tower, connected it to some sort of valve in the organ here, tried to give him air, but it was no use. The air hose? I hadn't thought of that. It would certainly explain the exploded intestines. I don't believe you, I said. Even as I spoke, I heard a sudden stirring in the church behind Benson and the magistrate, followed by the hollow banging down of a kneeling bench onto the stone floor. Rescue was moments away. Help! I shouted in as high-pitched and blood-curdling a voice as I could manage. Help me!
Please help me.
There was a shuffle of footsteps, and then a large face appeared over the magistrate's shoulder. A face with glasses as thick as the heart of Lucifer.
It was Miss Tanti.
What's going on here? She demanded.
Chapter 27. Never, not in my dopiest dreams, would I have believed I'd be so happy to see the woman. I brushed roughly past Benson and Magistrate Ridley Smith and took shelter behind Miss Tanti, peering round from behind her ample skirts.
What's going on here, Quentin? She repeated,
looking accusingly from one of my attackers to the other, and then at me, her thick spectacles focusing that frightful gaze like twin burning glasses.
A misunderstanding, the magistrate said,
with an apologetic and counterfeit chuckle.
Nothing more.
Misunderstanding, Benson echoed, as if entering his own plea.
I see, Miss Tanti said, wavering on the brink of what to do.
She seemed to be of two minds, or perhaps even more. For a long time she stared at them in silence, and they at her.
Come along, girl, she said suddenly, and whirling round seized my arm.
I winced. I hadn't realized how much Benson had hurt me. Without another word, she led me to the center aisle, and down it we marched together, like some nightmare bride and groom toward the door. Outside, the fog had lessened, although the air remained cool. The churchyard was empty. It was still too early for the ladies of the altar guild. No one was in sight. Out the door and down the walk we went toward the road, Miss Tanti pulling me along like a toy dog on a string. I must have hung back.
Come along, girl, Miss Tanti repeated. You've had a bad shock. I can see it in your eyes. We need to get you warm, get something hot and sweet into you.
I couldn't have agreed with her more. My knees were already beginning to tremble as we turned east toward Cater Street and Miss Tanti's house. I was suddenly exhausted, as if someone had opened a spigot in my ankle and let my energy pour out onto the ground. The idea of a cup of tea and a fistful of cookies was both oddly comforting and oddly familiar, like a fairy tale once heard and long forgotten. We were walking quickly now as we turned into Cater Street.
I forgot Gladys, I exclaimed, stopping suddenly. My bicycle, I left her in the churchyard.
I'll fetch her while you have your tea, Miss Tanti said. I shall ring someone up and have them drive you home.
I had a sudden, ridiculous vision of the someone, Miss Gore perhaps, herding me along the narrow road to Buckshaw with a shepherd's crook or a bishop's crozier, as if I were a wayward lamb.
It's very kind of you, I said.
Not at all, Miss Tanti replied, with the most awful and comforting grin.
We reached her house so suddenly that we might have been transported there by magic carpet.
Is this what shock does? I wondered.
Warps time. Was it possible to be in shock and yet, at the same moment, observe oneself being in shock? Miss Tanti fished in her pocket for a key and unlocked the door, which was odd, I thought, since nobody in Bishop's Lacey locks their doors. As we stepped inside and she shot the bolt behind us, the parrot called out from the conservatory.
Hello, Quentin. All hands on deck.
And it whistled four notes, which I recognized as the opening of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony.
Da-da-da-dum!
Hello, Quentin, I thought. That's what the bird had said when I was here before.
It was also the name Miss Tanti had called Benson.
No, wait, Benson's name was Martin.
She must have been addressing the magistrate.
Sit down, Miss Tanti commanded.
We had now magically arrived in her kitchen.
I'll put the kettle on.
I looked round at my surroundings, and they were blue. It's odd, but true. That's chiefly what I remember about it. Miss Tanti's kitchen was blue. I hadn't noticed it before. On the table was a milk pitcher full of decomposing lilies, a small breadboard, and half a loaf of Hovis bread, an electric toaster, a pewter candlestick with a partially melted candle, and a box of matches. It was obvious that Miss Tanti's meals were lonely ones. Then there was, in a jiff, a cup of tea steaming in front of me, and I was feeling peculiarly grateful. "Drink it," Miss Tanti said. "Take these. Eat them." She shoved a saucer of shortbreads under my nose, then turned away and began fussing with something in a cupboard. "Those men," she was saying, too casually, too conversationally. "Those men in the church, what were they doing to you?" "They thought I had found something," I said. "They wanted me to hand it over."
"And did you?"
"No," I said. The great goggles swung round and fixed me in their gaze.
"No, you didn't find something? Or no, you didn't hand it over?"
I looked into her eyes, mesmerized, and no words came.
"Well?"
Too late, the truth came crashing down. "I have to go home now," I said. "I'm not feeling well." Miss Tanti's hands appeared suddenly from behind her back. In one was clutched a glass bottle, and in the other, a handkerchief. She sloshed liquid onto the linen and clapped it to my nose. "Aha," I thought, "C2H520, diethyl ether again. I'd recognize its sweet, gullet-tickling odor anywhere." The chemist, Henry Watts, had once described it as having an exhilarating odor, and the Encyclopedia Britannica had called it pleasant. But it was obvious that neither Professor Watts nor the Encyclopedia Britannica